At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
The reason I think this is such a case-by-case basis, rather than a broad all-cancel culture must be something that is stopped or something that we realize is serious, is because there are instances in which I think people, and they don't have to be massive public figures, we can move on to the next, but they do make comments that in their own way can infringe on others' freedom of speech. Like, it also silences other people to put yourself out there and be to espouse hate speech, to dox people, to make things dangerous for other individuals, to do threats, right? Like, I think there has to be some way of saying that there are examples where this is okay and there are examples where this is obviously absurd. But yeah, before we start, I just want to ask, how are you feeling? Are you rested? I know you were back from that Charlie Kirk debate a while ago, before it took place.
Yeah. The actual debate was like October 1st, which is kind of crazy because, you know, like I guess it would have almost been better if I hadn't like said anything publicly about doing it until much later, because you know, from October 1st to when we could finally play it on the 25th, that's like 10,000 years of internet time. But the deal was they got it first to run like the first hour of it as an episode of Debate Night with Charlie Kirk. And then we would get it after that in the next GTA episode after it was the 25th, and then also Town Circle, who are the people who set it up in the first place, could play it then. So, you know, been back for a while, but I'm excited that it's out in the world now.
Yeah. All right. So we're definitely going to talk about it in a little bit, but I guess we should start by having a very good faith and friendly debate on cancel culture. That I almost feel like you and me have been putting off for a really long time, because we kind of do this thing where I have but the utmost respect for you, and there's times when you'll, you know, say or tweet things out online where I'm just like, you know, for the benefit of everyone, I'm not going to participate in the discourse, and I'm going to let that go by. And I know you've said the exact same thing to me in the same time, right? That, you know, there's times when I put takes out there where you're like, I definitely fundamentally disagree with what you're saying, Lance. But, you know, rather than just start an online war for everyone else to watch, I'm just going to stay on the side, right?
Yeah. Yeah, well, let's do it now. I don't know. I'll start. I hate you. You're horrible. Yeah, bye.
Nice. All right. We got our trailer, everybody. Okay, how about I start with this? This is probably the easiest place to start with. Yeah. I was going to knock out some of the things where I think we just fundamentally agree, so we don't waste time, because cancel culture is such a broad topic or such a broad subject. I think it's fair to say that you and me probably agree that the way that right-wingers describe it as is not something that we see as a fundamental problem. In that, say, like, Dr. Seuss as a private corporation has decided to stop publishing their own books on their own accord, and then the right-wing outrage machine says, well, that's because they're being canceled and we have to buy every Dr. Seuss book, or Mr. Potato Head as a private company deciding to change their name to Potato Head, and not even because it has something to do with trying to be part of the social justice scene, but because it's easier to sell a toy that doesn't have any gender, and then you have all the gender bits associated with, and that's, you know, them being canceled as well. Like, I'm pretty sure we're on the same page with conservative cancel culture, right?
Yeah, I mean, I don't, some of those controversies that you just mentioned, I don't really know enough to comment about, because they sounded incredibly stupid, so I never really looked into them. But I mean, I do think that there's a general thing that's happened since, like, I'm not even sure exactly, mid 2020 sometime, where, you know, I think like really specifically the American like Republican Party must have run a bunch of polls showing that like talking about cancel culture polled really well for them. And so everything became cancel culture. Even things like whatever was going on with Mr. Potato Head, or, you know, that like really have absolutely nothing to do with what everybody more or less seemed to mean by it. Like even in like 2019, you know, time moves quickly enough that it's kind of hard to remember this, but like in 2019, you know, there was a month where we all spent 6 years arguing about that letter to Harper's. And in that letter, all the discourse about that, that was all about like denouncing people and trying to get people fired, you know, which, like, whatever you think about that, none of that really has anything to do with these like weird controversies about, you know, like corporate branding and products and, you know, like all of that just seems like a completely separate issue to me.
Okay, good. So the cancel culture, then, I guess, that we disagree on, and then the one that you spoke about both in your book and in, you know, multiple Jacobin lectures, is the idea that online there's vast members of the left, because you do specifically want to talk about this in regards to leftists, right? You're not attacking this from a liberal perspective.
So I mean, I think I want to say two things. One of which is actually something I really do emphasize, especially in the main thing I wrote about this for Jacobin, which is an article called "So You're Still Being Publicly Shamed," is that this is not by any means exclusive to the left. I think these are like way broader trends, and you could absolutely find examples that have nothing to do with the left or even liberals. This John Ronson book, which I think, like, if people were going to read one thing about this, this is what I'd recommend. It's called "So You're Being So You've Been Publicly Shamed," from 2015. And it was kind of before the term had been coined. In fact, I don't think people were even saying call out culture yet, which was sort of the predecessor to cancel culture as terminology. And in some ways was probably better, because I think using this language of canceling introduces all these weird side issues that like make it really frustrating, make it easy to talk past each other. Like, what does being canceled mean? You know, do you have to be fired? Does your career have to be ruined? You know, like, I find all that really unhelpful, for reasons we can get into. But so that's one thing, right? That I think some of the best examples in the John Ronson book, are not at all about the left. Like, he talks about this girl, Lindsay Stone, who, worked for a group called Life that, you know, works with adults with learning disabilities. And, you know, basically she, this is like 2012 or something. She and her friend Jamie, would take sort of irreverent pictures of each other, oftentimes on their off hours, had nothing to do with doing their jobs. They both seem to be good at doing their jobs, but like they'd, you know, be stuff like one of them would be smoking in front of a non-smoking sign, shit like that. And, one of them was at Arlington National Cemetery, and it was in front of the sign that says "Silence and Respect." And Jamie takes a picture of Lindsay kind of going, like, you know, pretending like she's yelling at in front of the "Silence and Respect" sign, which, you know, whatever, you know, you can think it's a, you know, funny joke, you can think it's in bad taste, but like surely not a big deal. And this resulted in something that I think is like textbook canceling, which is that, you know, it sort of, probably she wasn't careful enough about her privacy settings. It went viral. There was like a Facebook group, you know, called Fire Lindsay Stone that had like 10,000 members. She was fired. She spent a lot of time, like, in the, you know, took like a year to find a new job. She wasn't really sleeping. She'd have trouble, you know, she wouldn't go out on dates because she was worried the guys would Google her, they'd see this. And one of the things I actually find really striking about this example is that if you look at the messages that were exchanged in that like Fire Lindsay Stone Facebook groups, it reminds me of nothing so much as the way that even in the middle of sort of pylons, people will always say, oh, don't worry, nobody's really canceled, you know, Lindsay will be fine, right? Don't turn her into a martyr. So that's one thing. I think that this stuff, to my mind, is kind of a product of this sort of high-tech neoliberal hellscape where people are incredibly atomized and alienated. They often feel most connected to others online. I think the profit incentives of the social media companies give them a reason to structure their product in a way that makes it more addictive, which actually encourages this kind of pile-on behavior. I also think it has more sting because most Americans work in non-unionized workplaces. So doxing has that special kind of terror that it wouldn't have as much of otherwise. So I think that would be, like, as far as what, you know, I think of as cancel culture, again, what I think most people meant in, like, 2019 when they talked about it. Now it's been stretched so far that we just need to retire the term. But, I mean, I think that's what they were talking about in my call-out culture before then. And I don't think it's exclusive to the left. I do think, though, I want to make sure, right, you know, because what you're asking about, latching on to a real thing that I definitely do think, which is that I think it's a strategic mistake for the left to buy into this stuff too much. You know, I think that sort of pylons, personal denunciations, attempts to get people fired or deplatformed, even though these are broad cultural trends that have nothing to do with the left specifically, I think they're particularly bad when we do them for a couple reasons, one of which is that I think that they sort of, that kind of intersects with our own sort of homegrown pathologies, which is that the left has been so far from power for so long that it's really easy for us to start to think of politics less in terms of a realistic attempt to change the world and more as a kind of attempt to take a symbolic moral stand against the way that the world is. And then when you combine that with these sort of cancely trends in the larger culture, I think you get some really bad stuff. And I think that when we're, I mean, you know, maybe it was a mistake, maybe it was good, but, like, you know, the reason that example, you know, canceling comedians was used for the title, even though most of the book is not even about canceling, but the reason it was used for the title is I just thought that it was obvious that it was the most sort of trivial example you could possibly come up with, right? Like, who has less power than comedians? So obviously if you're denouncing comedy, this is, like, the least sort of useful thing you could do. But of course, since we're living in 2021, and more people read titles and books, the bad part is that now, you know, there are going to be people walking around forever who think that I think that the most serious and important kind of oppression in the world is comedians getting yelled at, which is very close to the opposite of the point I was trying to make.
It was on timing, I'll give you that. Okay, one just quick thing. Your internet is really choppy. I don't know if you've got the stream open at the same time. That could help, or maybe multiple other things happening. It's just,
yeah,
it's,
let me close out everything else and see if it helps. All right, this is the only thing open in Chrome now. Let's try it.
All right. Okay. I think we're talking about multiple topics, so why don't we do them in order? Because the first one that you talked about, the idea of a, let's just say, a regular person, not a celebrity, not an e-celebrity, not a large online celebrity, but just a regular everyday person, a worker, getting fired for what happens to them on social media. Do you think it's fair to approach that on kind of a case-by-case basis? Like, do you think it's ever appropriate for someone and what they do outside of the workplace to affect what they do inside of a workplace?
Ever, sure, but I also think that we should want to society where we tend to err on the other side and where it's very hard to fire people for things that take place outside of the workplace. I mean, I'm not going to make an absolute claim here that, like, if somebody's job is they're, like, the equal opportunity enforcement officer and it turns out that they're in the Klan, you know, that can't be held against them, you know, that the like, there are definitely cases where it's relevant, and but I'm very leery of I'm very leery of kind of siding with make it easier for HR to do this stuff.
Absolutely. So let's take out the idea then that these are the like capitalist dynamic, because we're both lefties. So say these are all worker cooperatives. So you work in a worker cooperative, you have voting power in your worker co-op. Do you think it's fair if you had an employee who frequently outside of the workplace would just espouse the most ridiculous racist stuff, N-word this, Jewish conspiracy theory that, consistently online, and you in the workplace happen to be surrounded in a multiracial workplace in which you had black employees, you had Jewish employees. Would you then in that workplace think it was fair to either reprimand or fire them if you found that they were doing that on a regular basis?
I think it depends what their job was. But I also think that probably the more important thing than like what the right like outcome is on a case-by-case basis is what the process is. And even in a unionized workplace, it's much harder to fire people you have to do much more sort of legwork to show just cause than in a non-unionized workplace. And I would hope, that in a future where the economy was just blanketed with worker co-ops, that it would be even harder there that in a current like unionized but capitalist workplace, that it would be a little bit closer to the process for like removing a partner from a law firm or something, or at least a couple inches further down that like spectrum as opposed to the way that things are right now.
Yeah, for sure. So I could get on board with you for the idea of, say, old tweets, right? Firing someone for old tweets that they had before they even worked there, especially because I think people should be open to the idea of changing. So if you had old racist tweets from back in the day and you said, oh, I definitely condemn those, then yes, there's absolutely no ground to stand on. But you just mentioned the technology that makes all of this possible, especially the technology being social media, the modern version of it, right? To me, it's different than, say, someone going home to their family and saying, don't you hate the N-words to their family, like within private confines or whatever. No one will ever know about that, whereas social media is similar to someone standing at a bus stop suddenly with a megaphone and suddenly saying these kind of things, and then 10 people get interested, and then they show up at the bus stop next week to hear the next thing they say, and then they get even larger because social media can propagate what you say and amplify it, kind of idea, right? So in that sense, it is different perhaps than perhaps just having the separation between the workplace and who you are as a person, like who do you represent as a person, and does that in turn then make the workplace more dangerous? Because if you were someone coming into the workplace and say you were indigenous or you were a minority or you were trans or something, and then you show up every day and that same person there who says I wish death upon you outside of the workplace never says it in the job but says it every day when he gets out on social media, is there grounds there? I'm giving you extreme examples, right? Because I'm trying to find like
that is a very extreme example, but I think that I think that what the right outcome would be in a given case depends on both how extreme the content is, right? Not just like, I think there's a big difference between I wish death upon you and just expressing some kind of shitty or ignorant views. I also think it matters what the person's job is, right? Not all workplaces are created equal, not all jobs those workplaces are created equal. If somebody is in a position of managerial authority, I think that the standard should be lower than if you're a janitor, for example. I think that it's not an absolute claim that like nobody should ever, be fired for anything related to any of this, as that I'm extremely leery of sort of reasons to make it easier or sort of portrayed in a way that makes it is more sympathetic to make it easier for a couple of reasons. One is that I don't I think that bad people still have a right to employment, that I don't think that should be that should be conditional. Which is not to say that nobody could ever be fired for anything, but I think that there should be a very strong default in terms of the idea that even if you're a bad person, you have a right to employment, you have a right to support yourself. I'm also very skeptical of the idea of this as a strategy for reducing the amount of bigotry in society in general, right? I mean, like certainly one thing it's definitely not going to do is cause positive change in that person, right? I mean, if anything, it's going to be very much the opposite. And cause a lot of resentment in, you know, anybody, even if they didn't necessarily agree with the initial comment, you know, who
you're saying, sorry, public shaming that won't cause a change in the person.
Yeah, public shaming doesn't, and certainly firing people doesn't. I mean, you know, fire, you know, like that's going to be the opposite. I mean, that's going to really harden, you know, those, like, get people to dig in, right? I mean, nobody's ever said, well, now that I've been fired, I see that you're actually right all along.
Yeah. I totally agree with you on the firing aspect, but maybe I disagree with you on the public shaming aspect. But anyway, sorry, keep going.
Well, we should get into the public shaming, but my other reason for my other reason for being very leery about all this is that, especially if we're talking about, you know, I mean, I know earlier, you know, you sort of example where you said, let's assume we're talking about worker co-ops, but like, especially to the extent that we're talking about like real life arguments about things that are actually happening in capitalist workplaces, I think, I think it's extremely dangerous to sort of, hand them that rationale that like, well, you know, social media is really different because it's, you know, because it's public and all that stuff, because, you know, the fact that, you know, there aren't like widespread firings of, you know, subversives like in the MacArthur era over stuff that we're saying on social media right now is largely a function of the fact that we're not seen as a serious threat to anybody, right? Like no need for a Red Scare if you're not actually scared of the Reds. Whereas I think if we did get to the point where we were actually seen as a threat to capital and the existing state, I think that we'd see a lot more of that. And I'd be very leery about saying that, like, you want to water down the idea that, you know, your employer's sort of rights over you stop at the workplace, because of social media, because I can very easily see that being weaponized against the left.
Absolutely. Okay, well, let's take that example, because you talked about the McCarthyite era. In that time, right, you could be fired from your workplace if they believed that you were a communist or a communist sympathizer. So it's a little bit similar today, because I think in many ways, like, you're familiar, obviously, with the Overton window and that kind of idea, right? That, you know, societal trends change over time. What is socially acceptable today was not socially acceptable a decade ago, kind of thing. And now we find ourselves in a situation where what is socially acceptable is also reflected by brands, right? Like, Pride Month comes along, every single brand has to show the Pride flag to show how, you know, prideful they are. We now have woke marketing and woke advertising and stuff like that. But those are basically them reflecting what they think is acceptable by society and what will sell better, because at the end of the day, it's for a profit motive. So in the similar way, how they could fire people back in the day, say, for thinking that they were communist or other things beyond that, right? Nowadays, the same argument could be used to say perhaps they want to fire people because these people are either making the workplace unsafe through the propaganda of bigotry or doing things that are completely like 10 years ago, it would have been socially acceptable to make all kinds of offside jokes about gay people at the workplace. It would have been fine. Mm-hmm. You could have done that, right? Nowadays, if you did that, it would be like, whoa, what are you doing? Like, you can't say that kind of stuff. And then if you want to reflect that within social media, those same trends will continue. Do you feel like that draws a parallel to it?
I'm not quite sure what you're getting at there, but I think that the sort of point that interests me about this and what often really worries me about this is I hear leftists, you know, like people, like really radical leftists, sort of saying, like, you know, when they're emphasizing that some sort of fired or deplatform is fine, like really emphasizing, well, it's a private corporation. Which I think is like a right wing libertarian notion of free speech, right? That that it's, you know, that only government can be a threat to a private corporations, you know, can't be a threat to it. And it's also one that sort of makes what we think about the McCarthy era a little confusing in retrospect, because you could say the same thing about the Hollywood blacklist, that those were just private companies, you know, exercising, you know, their property rights, you know, their rights of free association. But, you know, the traditional left view is that, you know, the what went on in the McCarthy era, even on the private side, you know, take HUAC out of it, just the Hollywood blacklist and all of that, was a free speech problem in itself. Now, again, this doesn't mean you can't have conflicting values. This doesn't mean that, I mean, obviously, I think it's a good thing that you can't, that, like, you know, you I mean, if you're like making, you know, a homophobic joke in the workplace, like in your example, that like, I think the fact that like, it's, there are many more places where you can't get away with that now is a good, you know, is a good thing. You know, I'm not absolutist about this, but I do really worry about leftists sort of selectively taking up these, this kind of libertarian capitalist kind of notion of freedom and using that to deflect, oh, this isn't a problem, that's not a problem. I think we should have a higher standard.
Yeah, for sure. But to me, framing it that way kind of cedes power to those corporations, because it kind of gives them the ability to have what they already do, which is to become the arbiters of our speech. And I know you're someone, for example, who would be for breaking up big tech and things like that. But I guess in your opinion, because we don't have the power to do that yet, you feel that there's a more pressing argument to be made for leftists then to change their own behavior online, rather than advocate for things that may be out of their power.
Okay. No. I actually don't think that breaking up big tech makes that much sense, which is a little bit sideways what we're arguing about now. But I think that this example really kind of shows the limits of that kind of liberal trust bust in politics, because I don't think that breaking up can go very far here. You know, like you could separate Facebook and Instagram. You could even separate Facebook from Facebook Messenger. But if all Zuckerberg was controlling was just Facebook, right, that would be a massive part of the flow of information in our society. Similarly, like if the only thing that, you know, YouTube was unaffiliated with Google and the only thing they owned was Google, you know, that would still be a massive part of the flow of information. So my solution isn't breaking it up. My solution is actually nationalizing it, which I've been on the record as saying. And I do think we should advocate that, right? I mean, I have advocated that. But in fact, you know, so maybe I'm not following the reason you're bringing it up, but I mean, just to complete the thought, I mean, one of the reasons that I advocated actually is that I think that having a few tech overlords get to decide, you know, what you can say and what you can't say is incredibly dangerous. And I think
we both agree on that.
If this were public, certainly in a context like the US where we have this very strong sort of legal protection for free speech in the public sector. I mean, that's why when Ronald Reagan was governor of California, he tried to fire Angela Davis for being a member of the Communist Party. You know, the courts bounced it back and said, no, you have to come up with a different rationalization, because you can't fire a public employee, you know, because of their political affiliations. And similarly, if, you know, Facebook and Twitter and YouTube were publicly owned, then the First Amendment would apply to them. Now, that doesn't necessarily mean you couldn't have any rules. If there's a public comment section, you know, portion of your city council meeting, you can't like go up to the mic and start like, you know, screaming swear words and, you know, racist, you know, epithets, you know, at the people, right? I mean, there are, it's not a completely unregulated forum, right? But it does mean that the rules would, that, you know, you'd have a higher bar for having to prove that, you know, that you were protecting free speech. And I know that like some people on the left, when I make this argument, crazy about that, because I think what they're primarily thinking about is sort of bad and dangerous and objectionable speech. And I'm not going to deny that. I mean, I think there are real trade-offs here.
Yeah.
But I'm much more long-term, you know, because I'm an incredibly optimistic person, right? I mean, like I would say late capitalism, you know, because I want to believe that it's actually late, right? You know, it's not like, you know, still very early capitalism. So because I'm an incredibly optimistic person, I'm less worried about bad stuff getting through than I am about good stuff being censored. Which, for sure. I think again, if you go with the premise that we're going to have that it's possible and, you know, plausible that we could have a rebuilt and powerful left that's not just like a few cliques of like social media users and YouTube hosts yelling at each other, you know, but like, you know, it involves like the sort of mass working class organization that it would take to actually achieve our goals, you know, then I'd start to become much more worried, you know, about how they're going, you know, about, you know, about the, you know, the left, you know, the left being censored. So I think there are principled reasons and also kind of pragmatic reasons to worry about that. But I'm not sure that any of this is intersected with what you're getting
okay,
at.
Okay, well, the reason I bring it up is that if you were to say, let's use your example, you want to nationalize the speech, or sorry, nationalize social media companies, right? At which point, what I'm trying to get at is your prescription here, rather than state something like, it is of the utmost necessity for us to be able to have, you know, good discourse, both in the left and in general society, for us to now nationalize social media companies because they're the arbiters of our free speech in the current paradigm, and that's a bad thing. It's more you're coming at this from a prescriptive statement that we as leftists need to stop concentrating on this kind of an online cancel or cultural war topics, things like that you may find, I guess, at times ridiculous, because I guess we all have a level for that. We all have a tolerance towards what we find like absurd. Mm-hmm. Like you, the example you keep giving is the DSA clapping one, right? Which to me, yes, I can completely agree. That doesn't win people over to the left. If you have to show up and you've got such a sensitive hearing problem that like you might want to wear headphones or something if you're going to an auditorium full of people who are going to clap, like it's just something that you yourself should be aware of. I can agree with you there. But then I said the reason I think this is such a case by case basis rather than a broad all cancel culture must be something that is stopped or something that we realize is serious is because there are instances in which I think people, and they don't have to be massive public figures, we can move on to them next, but they do make comments that in their own way can infringe on others' freedom of speech. Like it also silences other people to put yourself out there and be to espouse hate speech, to dox people, to make things dangerous for other individuals, to do threats, right? Like I think there has to be some way of saying that there are examples where this is okay and there are examples where this is obviously absurd.
Yeah, I mean, I guess I don't disagree with that, but sort of cycling back, to the first thing you said and then kind of going back to the end, sure. You said that I wouldn't see that as a rather than thing. I just say both, right? I mean, like yes, we, in addition to, right? You know, we should advocate sort of bigger structural solutions for society, but I actually think there are a lot of areas where we're all sort of used to saying both, that like both we could see that some social problem is much bigger than like what we do, right, our behavior, but also that we think that there are certain sorts of behavior that are a bad idea for us to participate in. Like I think an obvious, I think racism itself is an obvious case like that, or sexism or any of these others, right, that these aren't, you know, I mean, as I hope, you know, materialists, like we've got some analysis of where these things come from that's not just about individual choices. You know, we think that there are sort of deep structural roots and that, you know, we can't, you know, we can't like, you know, Robin DiAngelo our way out of, you know, racism being a problem. But also, bad idea for leftists to say racist things, right? Because both morally it's a bad idea and also it's a bad idea because it divides the working class. So I think that we can kind of walk and chew bubblegum the same way with some of this cancel culture stuff it's not just something that like comes from the individual, you know, it's not just a matter of a bunch of individuals making bad choices. There are these much larger problems with our society that it comes from, but also we could say it's unhealthy when the left participates in some of that stuff. So that's one thing.
But it's still a case. Sorry, it's still a case by case basis in what they participate in terms of their cancel culture.
So you said, actually, sorry, I might have lost the thread. So you said that. And
there could be examples. I said that there could be examples in which I think we both agree are ones that are it's not productive for the left to engage in. And I also agree with some of the thesis in your book where the very act of engaging in some of them, as seen by outsiders, would actually detract people from wanting to participate in the left or progressive politics because they're like, look how upset all these people are getting online about something like this, right? So there are instances of this, but the reason right, I think, okay. rather than denouncing it as a whole, and why I find that problematic, is there are times when it is justified, when people's anger and their comments directed towards a person are with utility.
Okay, I got it. So I think I'd probably say two things about that. One is that, this a lot, right? You say, oh, but don't you think there are things that people should be canceled for? And sometimes with people who are not nearly as subtle as you are, like it'll be like, oh, but like, what if, like, I don't know, Charles Manson is on Twitter, you know, and you know, can you, you know, sure. denounce him? It's like, sure, right? Or like, you know, Harvey Weinstein, you know, I'll like, I mean, yes, it should be in jail, you know, so certainly the least you could do is denounce him, I guess. But I think that what we're really talking about, especially when we talk about, you know, use that sort of imperfect but evocative phrase, cancel culture, is whether people are, you know, whether the sort of trend line is to being too hair trigger about this stuff or not, right? It's not that there's nothing that anybody would ever, you know, it's like that, you know, that you should ever kind of, you know, be harsh about. I mean, clearly there is. And I'd also say that it is interesting though, cause the way you put that, was you said that, there are things that people can do. And one of your examples, I certainly agree with, is doxing and, you know, and you, but you also, you know, talked about hate speech and other things, that, you know, that end up infringing on others' rights. And I agree with all that, but I also think that there's some tension here, not necessarily with what you think, because I don't know if you think this or not, but with what I often hear from people on the left who I think are too dismissive of the whole subject, which is that, canceling is just criticism. That, you know, people complain about canceling, they're really just complaining about being criticized, that nobody's really harmed by any of this stuff, you know.
I think that's a good way to segue into canceling celebrities then, instead of just regular everyday people, because
whether it's celebrities or normal people, right? I think that one of my problems with that whole line of thought has always been right. that it always kind of seems like playing dumb a little bit to think that there's, you know, to equate sort of like savage mass pylons with criticism, right? I mean, I think we all actually know the difference between criticizing somebody and like, you know, furiously denouncing them and saying that, you know, that they're a piece of shit and anybody who associates with them is a piece of shit and like the kinds of things, you know, like if you, like one of the, I already mentioned the John Ronson book, like something else I find really helpful here. I know it's not an uncontroversial example, but is the Natalie Wynn canceling video. And if you think about the sort of 2-minute segment of the video where she's like reading off the tweets, you know, mm-hmm. I think the things that are being, I think that everybody knows the difference between that and criticizing, right? Sure. I don't think they're the same, but in fact, I think that there's often some tension between willingness to see that when we're talking about, you know, hate speech, to say, well, this can cause real harm. This sort of view that people often have when they're talking about canceling, that it's just criticism, or, you know, if you're whining about mean tweets, you just need to toughen up, or how does this hurt you? You can just log off. Because, absolutely. Of course, every single one of those things could be said about like harassing sexist speech online, for example. And I think not all of them, right? Obviously there's a larger context in one case, there's not in the other, but I think that a lot of the reasons why we wouldn't accept that in that example, I think are also reasons why we shouldn't accept it in this one.
Okay. So the reason I wanted to differentiate just between, you know, people with smaller accounts or just everyday people and e-celebrities or celebrities mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call them. And like, I'm glad you brought this up as an example, is because people like, say, ContraPoints, for example, or, you know, and I'm a huge fan of ContraPoints, so I don't see ContraPoints as like an enemy or a problem. I'm actually just a big fan of her work. But someone, say, like conservatives or other people that we target, they have very, very large audiences. They have very large megaphones. Mm-hmm. What they say can influence thousands, if not tens of thousands, and in some cases, places like Joe Rogan millions of people at once. So to me, if just one thing that Joe Rogan said will have a much greater effect than, say, something that just a common worker who's about to get fired for saying something transphobic will say. So that is why I hold them to a different standard online. Like, you and me are both online personalities. We've both had our share, I'm sure, of death threats, hate mail, tons and tons of people online on Twitter attacking me consistently. Anything I tweet will be, you know, polarizing to a lot of people. But that kind of comes with the territory, in my opinion, because, you know, as you amass a large following and audience, so too do you also have a responsibility in your messaging to those people. So if there is a mass swath of people who are like, and especially if it's coming from the left, it feels even worse, as was the case with Natalie, right? And we can talk about the Buck Angel thing afterwards. Then I think that there should be room open for people to listen, especially when there's a large amount of people who are marginalized, especially saying to you, hey, by the way, what you're saying is problematic. Here's why. Can, before we even have to do the whole, like, you're scum or shit, I hate you, more like, this is a problem, and can you, like, you know, change your opinion on this, for example? Like, larger creators often don't do that.
Yeah, although I also think that there's that realistically you're probably least likely to get a hearing for that if it's framed and you know, if it sort of comes from in the form of mass denunciation, you know, like saying in that case that you know, that somebody you know, like making what seemed to me, you know, be really over the top, you know, accusations there. I mean, like I don't disagree with, I think, your larger point that that the more sort of you know, the bigger somebody's megaphone is, the more it's like reasonable to that they, I don't know, maybe should accept it. Although I also think that, like, I also think that's a bad excuse for participating in it, right? You know, that, like, you know, it's one thing to sort of say, like, well, this comes with, you know, there are a lot of things that come with the territory, but, you know, just because something comes with the territory, I don't necessarily think that that means that, like, the person who participates in it is off the hook, right? You know, that like,
well, no, you know, women technically, everyone is on the hook for just participating in it collectively, right? Each one of us is doing it in opposition. Like, are you canceling James Lindsay when you quote tweet him and then say something about how utterly absurd he is, or how terrible his take is, or how horrible a person he is?
Yeah, like, I think this I think goes back to what I was saying about why I think canceling is a really, you know, I mean, like, I think the thing that points to is a real thing, but I think it's a really unfortunate term for it, because it's so vague, right? And like this whole subject of, okay, what does it mean to cancel? What is canceling? You know, like it's I think that that's, I mean, I just find those discussions, like, super unhelpful, because I think that I think that what people are talking about, we use the term cancel culture, is a certain kind of atmosphere of mutual surveillance and hair trigger denunciation. But I think, like, asking of individual actions, right, is this, you know, does this count as canceling or not, is oftentimes not really a very productive discussion, because it's also, I think, in terms of the effect that we're worried about, I think that, like, having, you know, having the, oftentimes, right, I mean, if, like, one or two people are doing something, that's not, it's legitimately not a very big deal, you know, and if 10,000 people are, then I think realistically that's going to have a much bigger psychological effect. I mean, the James Lindsay example, I think, is interesting, because certainly one thing it does show is that, you know, I mean, I must think that, you know, mockery has its place, which, I mean, obviously I do, right? I mean, I was on the you know, I did a segment on Michael Brooks show for a year and a half. So, you know, like, I'm obviously not anti-mockery. But I think that, you know, I think that there's that what would be more objectionable to my mind, even with James Lindsay. And look, James Lindsay, it's going to take a lot for me to be, like, upset about anything on his behalf, because I actually think he does a lot of harm, you know, in the larger world, you know, but
as do I. But then, see, that's really important what you just said there, because in the other instances, you may not see the same harm that someone else is doing, and you see it as them being canceled effectively because either you're a fan of their work or you don't relate to the way in which they're being criticized. Do you think that's fair? Because to someone outside, they could be seeing you doing that to James Lindsay and say, wow, Ben Burgess is effectively trying to cancel James Lindsay for his really shitty takes on CRT, which I agree with. He has incredibly shitty takes, right? But we're both on the same side of that issue.
But I'd also say that in this case, right, that they that like what we mean when we say this isn't even just that, like, he has bad takes and the sort of takes do harm. But I mean that, like, legitimately that his sort of direct institutional role does harm, right? That, like, that he does things like testify before state legislatures to get them to pass these authoritarian laws, all of which, the only point I was making there, that doesn't mean that, like, there's nothing that you could do to James Lindsay that might necessarily not fall into some of these categories. The only point I was making there is just that, like, I mean, this is something I know we agree about, right? That I'm not going to feel, I'm not going to feel too torn up about it, right? And I agree with your point that that like, a lot of times what if we're just talking about, like, whether you feel sorry for individuals or not, if that's the question, which I actually think is probably the least interesting question to ask, but if that is the question, whether or not you feel sorry for individuals, then yeah, it's a judgment call, and reasonable people who have different experiences and different different priorities will make different judgment calls. I agree with all that, right? But I think that the more interesting questions to ask are not kind of did this person, have it coming or not? Which, maybe there are certain things that I think that, like, nobody would, right? If you have, like, 1,000 people, tweeted that somebody should die or they should be raped or whatever. Like, I sort of don't think anybody has it coming. I'm a softy that way. But more generally, abstracting away from the most extreme cases, if we're just asking, does this person have it coming? Does that person have it coming? Sure. We might have disagreements because we're, like I said, we're making different judgment calls. But I think the more important questions are less about sort of evaluating individual cases than about is there a general trend here that's concerning? And are we acting in ways that feed into it too much? And you said what you're going to say.
Okay, well, on that very point, I think that these things have kind of existed in society, and what we've done with social media, and maybe the only positive thing I'll ever say about Twitter, is it's democratized the ability for people to be able to reach, like, the plebs can finally throw their dung directly at Elon Musk's face. Does it have any material effect? Does it actually create change? No. But the very idea of perhaps being upset at people calling Elon Musk space Karen, and then suddenly he sees that tweet and he responds to it, and the catharsis of being like, you asshole, right? That to me, I do not see as, like, a broader problem. Like, because I know we keep encompassing this all as this one giant term, cancel culture, right? But I feel like it's something that's being done regardless. It's just we differentiate to be the utility of various examples.
Sure. I mean, like I said, I mean, if the whole issue here were about, like, you pick the 3 or 4 worst people in the world, and if the discussion centers around them, then I can see your point of view a little bit more. I would point out that the vast majority of people who this stuff happens to are not Elon Musk or James Lindsay, the overwhelming majority of humans are not Elon Musk or James Lindsay. So it's kind of impossible for the majority of the problem to affect them. So like, the only point I'm making here is just that I think we can separate, is something a worrying social problem? Are we crying any tears about, the half dozen worst human beings alive being victims of that problem? Because I think on the second question, we agree that the answer is no, but I think that's consistent with the answer to the first question is yes. And when people say, well, none of this is new, I mean, I think that there's a way that that's sort of true, but I think there's a way in which it's not, right? That the way in which it's true is, look, do you have taboos in every society? Do you have cases where people are sort of denounced or shamed in unfair ways in every society? Sure. But you know, that's what I said. I think that what we're really talking about here is trends, right? Like, is it the case, for whatever reason, and I agree with you, that the sort of technological change, the innovation of social media, is a big piece of the problem. I don't think it's the whole problem, but I think it's a big piece of the problem. That you know, is it the case now, you know, this stuff has a much, you know, a much shorter fuse, essentially. And I think
I'd agree
I think
with
the
you,
answer,
yes, there, of course. That's just, it's just the way the algorithms and the AI manipulate us in that way, right? Shorter fuses and people are more prone to fighting online, kind of thing.
And I think, you know, and I think that, yeah, I mean, but when you talk about the algorithms and all that stuff, I mean, sometimes, I mean, this might not be the spirit which you entered, but sometimes people sort of say that in a dismissive way. It's like, oh, that's just Twitter being Twitter or whatever. But I mean, I think Twitter
being
Twitter is
a big problem.
Oh, no, it's a
massive problem. I agree. No, yeah. We're on the exact same page there, 100%. For me, I don't see the distinction between, like, in the case of, say, ContraPoint's Natalie Wynn being canceled over someone like Buck Angel. For me, as a cis, you know, man, not fully understanding that world, I had to do a whole bunch of research on Buck Angel first. And so to me, it was like, why are people angry at her for this? And then once I learned that Buck Angel was not only a transmedicalist, but that he was also responsible for outing one of the Ratajkowski sisters, which is one of the most dangerous things you can do to a trans person, and continues to be a transmedicalist. Like, he still uses his identity as a, like, an icon in the queer community, as well as just like a legend who's been in this for so long, to continue to push views that are directly harmful to the trans community. I understand completely why people would be upset if you associate with him. I am not a Six Degrees of Cancellation person, so I don't think, like, and now ContraPoints is responsible for anything that Buck Angel does, even if she disagrees with his takes, right? I think that in itself is a problem, but surely...
I mean, that's what I was going to say. I mean, I think the problem there is if everything you're, you know, if everything you're saying is right, and I mean, I think the transmedicalist stuff is, I think the... I think the he said she said of a decades old you know divorce, I'd be more reluctant to weigh in on, if only because I'm probably not going to do that research, but I think that the problem is that, like, I think these are good, you know, and this is where we might be sort of usefully latching on to larger issues, you know, that the, you know, the sort of moralism I find counterproductive is not so much getting mad at Buck Angel, it's getting mad at Natalie because of guilt by association, because she gave Buck Angel, you know, 5 seconds of voice work and then you know, was very willing to express her disagreement with him, but wasn't willing to, like, you know, disavow him and shun him, and that's where I have much more of an issue than with the getting mad at Buck Angel himself.
Okay, so what about an example like J.K. Rowling?
Yeah, I mean, I think J.K. Rowling. I mean, I think J.K. Rowling, like, says a lot of stupid shit. I think you know, not like J.K. Rowling, you know, makes, you know, like I certainly see where that comes from. I would question in terms of the goal of making her views less common, the sort of way in which the sort of denunciation and you know, has happened in the way it's been expressed and all that is likely to lead to fewer people having those views, or it's actually more likely to lead to a certain sort of narrative, you know, being constructed by people who do have bad views on this, right?
Do,
so you mentioned
you feel
at the beginning
this,
of the conversation.
Well, I was just going to ask, do you feel the same way when you quote tweet Jordan Peterson or, again, James Lindsay as having the same effect?
But I mean, I don't know, but I also don't think that when I quote tweet Jordan Peterson or James Lindsay, I'm saying that they're pieces of shit and they should die, right?
Like, no, I don't not, think that's not at all. But the vast majority of the criticisms towards J.K. Rowling from prominent figures like myself, because I would often quote tweet her, are about the things that she was directly saying and why they're harmful and why they're bad.
I mean, look, I think if all you're doing is like, if all you're doing is making fun of something that she said, God bless. I'm certainly not going to criticize you for that.
Not just making fun of it, but pointing out why it is actively harmful, why like TERF rhetoric is actively harmful to, you know, the trans community, for example. In the same way that I think I think properly call out Jordan Peterson or James Lindsay for their incorrect takes on things like CRT or their incorrect takes on a variety of topics, right?
I agree with you that the two are parallel, right? Like that, okay. Like what should go for one should go for the other. But again, I mean, I think that sure you're right. I mean, without having looked at the numbers or anything, like we'll take it as a given, right? That you're right about the proportions, right? That most of it's that. But I also think we need to talk about the other part because some of that stuff could be super counterproductive. So like you mentioned Against the Web at the beginning of the conversation. And one of the things that Michael talks about in Against the Web is the way that, the way that like student activists at Evergreen gave us all, gave Brett Weinstein to the world. Right. We would never have to hear from this. Pinker probably less so because Pinker, I think, had more of a public profile from his like apolitical writing before. But like Brett Weinstein was like a biology professor at this like small liberal arts hippie college that nobody's ever heard of except for this controversy. Like we would never hear, Brett Weinstein's opinions if not for the fact that student activists, Evergreen went after him in kind of a crazy way. And similarly, I think that this is not an uncommon thing that happens, that certain kinds of ways of kind of expressing anger at these figures or sort of going after them in a way that might be emotionally satisfying or trying to get them deplatformed actually builds a lot of these people's careers. Like what would ultimately Milo Yeaton, I never know how to pronounce his last name, Milo Y. That dude.
Yeah.
Milo Yiannopoulos ultimately he was effectively deplatformed by the right, when CPAC and his publisher decided to drop him because of the age of consent stuff. But like that dude would never have had any sort of career if not for left attempts to deplatform him, because that was his entire gimmick, right?
I would hard disagree with you there.
The dangerous F word tour, the only thing that got anybody to pay attention to that guy, like there's no, otherwise like he's just a dime a dozen.
I totally know where you're coming from when it comes to Milo, because it did seem for a long time that he was one of those people who just basically made his fame on the backs of outrage, like just an outrage fame tour. But I'm just doing a documentary right now on Gamergate. He was actually heavily promoted in right circles by Steve Bannon, and Steve Bannon utilized him as his Gamergate liaison for Breitbart, and then that started to thrust him into the mainstream right-wing ecosystem. That's when Rubin started hosting him. That's when he started going on like major news networks and stuff. That was before his dangerous comedy tour had even taken place. He was being propped up by Gamergate effectively.
Okay, so I mean that's his origin story, but I mean like,
yeah. I think that if
Bannon had a long term interest in sort of voted this guy and bringing him to kind of to prominence, right? That the best thing that ever happened for that plan, was that could say, oh, however many people are rioting and, Berkeley, cause he's trying to speak. I think that's a huge, gift to him. I mean, I think there are limited examples where it doesn't have this effect. But I think that's usually when it's being applied to people who don't really have a base. Right?
Okay, so then wouldn't the real like, problem
so,
be
so oh, sorry, so, so like so like you know Richard Spencer could be punched in the street and like 99% of everybody in the world just thinks it's funny, but that's because 99% of everybody in the world
hates Nazis. but wouldn't you say then the broader problem, rather than just saying as a blanket statement it's cancel culture, is misdirected perhaps movements from time to time, because they're not going to be, they're not going to be all the same, that sometimes amplify rather than detract while not actually attacking a real system of power. That's what I think you have issue is. Like, that's what you take umbrage with ultimately, right? Is if there is going to be a bunch of people who think that they're actually changing the world by doing something like banning Ben Shapiro from speaking at a college, when in turn that makes Ben Shapiro more famous because he says, I just owned and destroyed those, you know, those libs on campus, and then goes to do another thing. That's what is more damaging to you.
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I do think that there is a both and thing here, because I think that we can, and I agree with you that we need to disentangle some of these threads. But I mean, I also think that independently, right, I think both that there's a sort of broader cultural trend here that's concerning, and I kind of tried to lay out that case a little bit earlier. But also, you're right. I mean, what I'm concerned, you know, the broader cultural trend, I mean, I talk about, like, you know, kind of this much in the book, and then, like, there's that Jacobin article, So You're Still Being Publicly Shamed, where I, you know, I talk about that a lot more. But you're right that my main focus has been on the second thing, you know, that, like, because my, you know, because mostly, you know, what I'm concerned about is the left, because, you know, because I, you know, because I want the left to win, right? I mean, I don't, you know, like, so if we're doing things that are counterproductive, or we're doing things that are, like, sort of eating each other alive, you know, then, like, I'm concerned about that, you know, because I think it's bad for us. I mean, if the right eats itself, then I'll, you know, just, like, pop some popcorn and watch. Like, that sounds good to me.
Yeah. I mean, maybe a good way to wrap this up is you were talking about Brooks' book, and he seemed to talk a lot about that near the end of it, and that there has to be a broader consensus to unify the left with purpose. The only thing I can reconcile is that the entire book's premise is making fun of individual bad media actors. You know, your Ben Shapiro's, your Jordan Peterson's. Like, that's every chapter is a different one of them. And, you know, the negative. Sorry, go ahead. Yeah.
I mean, I hope I've made clear that I'm not against that. Like, I don't. I mean, I don't think that the. I don't think it should be our only sort of tool, you know, for pushing back against these figures. That's actually something I talked about a lot in the first book. But I do. You know, I think something I said. Every single time, right? Like, I promoted the first book. You know, I'm sure I said this to you when I was on the old podcast and all that, you know, like I think a line I used every single time is look, I mean, I'm not going to deny that mockery, you know, has its place. Right. I mean, like I think we could be targeted, you know. I think that there's, I think that if it's sort of our default, you know, as is sort of, you know, mockery of individuals as opposed to the thing, you know, that, like, and especially when we turn that internally, you know, that can get unhealthy. But, like, yeah, I mean, I don't, you know, I mean, I'm certainly never going to tell anybody that they can't or shouldn't, you know, make fun of these figures, and not just because it would be incredibly hypocritical if I did that.
So you've just been listening to an episode of The Surf Times. And if you enjoy it and want to see The Surf Times, you can go to wearesurfs.com or watch the live shows at thesurfs.tv. And also everywhere social media is sold, basically thesurfs.tv. You'll find us there, twitter.com/thesurfstv, for example. It would also help us out tremendously if you could leave a good review of this podcast if you enjoyed it, either on, I don't know, iTunes or wherever you're podcasting. Apparently it does help, and yeah, we hope to see you soon.
To our gods, Xander Corvus and Peyton L. Joost, we will build a ladder to heaven to deliver you the daily news. To our monarch, Tom Spiker, we are your most humble of clownish jesters. To our lords, Trevor R. and Alexander Thaler, you have our undying fealty. To our knights of the round table, Nate, that one guy, Hagbird Celine, Matthew Scarborough, Stellar Vision, Ariana McCarthy, Daniel Sutton, Ants Are Still Running the World, Coulter Smith, Tom Groh, Val 9000, Jenna Tal, Quiet 185, Anna Loves Riley, Riley and Anna, Omni, Poodle Hawk, The Tim Caucus, Multi Mondi, Trevor Janis, Lemmy 101, Anthropofojack, Saren 42, Chronic to Hemp Hog, Catherine, Radical Maniac, Ramon Acosta, Incosin, Violent Orchard, Sophie Baby, Political Puppy, Andreas Chiringuito, Zach Christensen, Josh Mickelson, Todd Buckingham, and Todd Lajeunesse. We shall meet you in the tavern, and we raise a drink, and we salute you.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.